I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What happens to America as the largest generation ever gets older? Walker Smith says get ready because baby boomers are not going home to retire. Instead, they will be out seeking their next new adventure. Walker is with us to tell us what he's learned about aging boomers and his new book, Generation Ageless. Mark Stern has new evidence from Philadelphia that cultural activity in a neighborhood is derived in part from diversity and leads to increased land value. Mark has labeled the phenomenon natural cultural districts, and he's here to tell us how cities can take advantage of the opportunities they present. Plus, Keith Bellows, editor of National Geographic Traveler, will give us the inside on Phoenix and Tokyo. That and more on today's Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Walker Smith is a familiar voice on Smart City with his weekly City Views essays, but today he's going to tell us what he's learned from years of research about the 78 million aging baby boomers for his new book, Generation Ageless. Walker is president of Yankelovich Partners, the company that first coined the term baby boomers. He oversees the Yankelovich Monitor, the foremost tool tracking America's lifestyles and values. Walker, I presume you are a boomer living this story. What did the data tell you about boomers and how they're aging that runs contrary to your own experience?
Well, I am a boomer, Carol. I was born right in the middle of the baby boom. And I think what our research has found is that baby boomers are reinventing the process of aging. They're doing it attitudinally. They are enjoying a lot of the fruits of advances in medicine and lots of things that are making it possible for them to live a different kind of old age than we have seen in the past. But their attitudes about aging are very different as well. And it's this combination of this new opportunity to live a longer, healthier old age combined with a different attitude about the opportunities and possibilities presented by old age that is creating this new generation of aging baby boomers that we see in the marketplace.
Describe the different attitudes.
Well, you know, traditionally we have thought about the years past the age of 65 as a time of retirement. And by the way, I say this traditionally only meaning really since about the early 1930s when the Social Security Act was signed into law. But since that point in time, we've had a very particular view of what it means to age and what it means to get older. And when we think about retirement, we think about a time of life that involves a few things. You know, it means not working. It means that you live on a pension or your savings. It means that you have a very mature view of the future and your limitations. You have, in effect, surrendered the reins to the next generation. And there's a sense of closure about life. You've settled into a final identity, and you're approaching life that is kind of the culmination of your experiences and your learning. And baby boomers don't share any of those views at all about how they want to look at their retirement. In fact, baby boomers have always been marked by a sense of possibility, of redefining themselves, of doing things differently, and exploring new opportunities and new adventures at every stage of their life. And so they're not really ready to settle into a final identity. They're not ready to surrender the reins of control to the next generation. They certainly don't have a mature kind of view of themselves. Youthfulness continues to be a defining characteristic of their psyche. And when it comes to something like work, baby boomers are going to continue to be engaged in their lives when it comes to work in ways that we haven't seen in prior generations. This is not to say that baby boomers are going to continue to work the same way they do today, but it is to say that work is not going to disappear from their lives the way it has for prior generations.
How will employers have to adjust to that, to make that part-time work, sometime work possible?
Well, I think employers have a big challenge when it comes to realizing the opportunities faced with baby boomers. For one thing, there are lots of predictions that they're going to need baby boomers in the workforce. There are a lot of concerns about job shortages as baby boomers retire. You know, if we lose 78 million workers in the American economy over the course of the next 19 years or so, the American economy will shut down. We simply have no way of replacing those workers. We can't do it through immigration. We can't do it through productivity gains. And the next generation behind baby boomers is simply not large enough to provide the numbers needed to make up for those for that decline in the workforce. So we are going to have to invent some new solutions. And so employers need baby boomers. And what they're going to have to do is figure out ways to provide them with the kind of work environments that are going to motivate them, give them the kind of work opportunities that are going to create for baby boomers a secure base from which they can explore new possibilities in their lifestyles and do different things. They're going to have to be much more flexible about how baby boomers manage their time. So baby boomers are going to be looking for more time off or for more flexibility in the way in which they manage their work hours. And I think most importantly, employers are going to have to provide health care benefits for baby boomers in ways that might feel uncomfortable or even unaffordable today. But if they're going to attract baby boomers, they're going to have to respond to the key things that baby boomers are looking for, and chief among those going forward will be health care.
It sounds like, other than healthcare, it sounds as if you've just described the prescription for attracting and retaining millennials.
Well, there is a lot of similarity, I think, between the ways in which baby boomers are looking at their future and the ways in which 20-somethings are now looking at their opportunities as well. In fact, in our book, what we talk about is a psychological concept that's recently been discussed, which I think is interesting. It's not anything that I would take quite literally, but Bruce Charlton, who is the editor-in-chief of a journal called Medical Hypotheses and teaches at the University of Newcastle upon Tyne in the UK, has argued that there is a new approach to maturity that defines success in the adult world of today. And it is one in which people do not settle into a fixed identity, but instead are always approaching each stage of their life as if they were younger. And what this means is always learning, always being open, always trying and experimenting with new things, as opposed to settling into a fixed identity. You know, we think of life as one in which we explore things as younger people, and then we settle into identity and get old and then decelerate into death. And Dr. Charlton is arguing that nowadays, success is really defined by a continuous sense of possibility. And so baby boomers are really the first generation in this new world, this world in which a continuing exploration of possibilities and continual learning and redefinition is, in fact, what it takes to be successful. The conditions of life nowadays demand that. And so you do see a lot of similarities between the ways in which baby boomers have always thought about their lives and are now thinking about their older years, and the ways in which we have traditionally thought about what younger people do as they're getting started.
Certainly learning, Walker, occurs in many ways, in many places. But as you talk about maturing adults, approaching life as being younger and wanting to continue to learn and explore possibilities, I think about our education institutions, which really seem not terribly prepared for delivering the kind of education experiences that maturing adults looking always for that new set of possibilities would really want to engage in. What's your attitude on that?
Well, I think there is a challenge there. I don't know that our traditional institutions are very well prepared at all for a generation of older people who want to become re-engaged in learning and explore something new in their older years. You know, we have to keep in mind that that baby boomers are really going to be the first generation in large numbers. You know, the prior generation is already beginning to enjoy this, but boomers are the first that will do this in large numbers to live a healthier old age. You know, boomers are going to live a decade or more of a healthier old age than prior generations. And so they're going to continue to be active and engaged in their lifestyles in ways that have never been true before. And so you look at educational institutions, you look at work, you look at politics. No matter what you look at, none of these institutions are prepared for a generation that is going to be able to participate in a way like we've never seen before. I think the challenge for educational institutions is going to be one of trying to determine how they can be relevant to a generation that wants to redefine itself, not simply dabble, you know, not simply get old and maybe mm-hmm. audit a class mm-hmm. or, you know, go to a community organization and do something for a few nights a week, but really become engaged in a new passion in their lives that may have nothing to do with anything that they've done before.
I think as you talk, I think about the challenges of working across generations, not as boss to employee or superior to inferior, but rather as colleagues. And I've experienced this myself. You know, I went back to school.
Yes.
Work collegially with people who are, you know, who are 20 years, 30 years younger than I am. And it's a very interesting experience. And it's funny, I also happen to watch, I'm a Grey's Anatomy fan, and I noticed this year, this season, they've introduced an older intern, and all of the residents are trying to figure out, well, how do they deal with this older intern? How
sure.
do they assert their authority over this person who's much older than them? So how do you see the working across generations, will that, as baby boomers take up new pursuits and engage in new passions, they're surely going to be in contact, unlike maybe
yeah.
the current older generation.
Right.
They're going to be working across generations.
Well, I think it's interesting. I actually think the real problem there is not going to be from baby boomers. I think it's more likely to be from the younger generation. I do think there's some cross-generational peacekeeping that's going to have to be done so that we can all get along. But, you know, baby boomers are quite comfortable hijacking things that are intended for younger people. My favorite example are just automobiles. You know, cars that have been designed to sell to younger drivers have been hijacked by baby boomers. You know, the Toyota Matrix, for example, was designed to target a driver with an average age of about 28 or 29. It actually turns out the average age of the driver of a Toyota Matrix is over 40. You know, the Honda Element was targeting the same average age driver. The average age of the Honda Element driver is 45. The Pontiac Vibe was 30, and it turns out to be 48. The Dodge Neon was 23. It turns out to be 39. You know, baby boomers have no shame in continuing to indulge their youthful sensibility. And I think this is something that continues to worry younger generations. You know, today's 30-somethings, you know, so-called Generation X, has long been concerned. There are a lot of public study groups and think tanks that have been formed around how younger people can avoid being saddled with the debt of the older baby boomer generation, you know, when it comes to things like Social Security and Medicare. And so lots of these concerns don't come so much from baby boomers as they do from younger generations. And I think we're all in for a change here, because baby boomers are pioneering a style of old age that is very new, yet it is a style of old age that younger people today are going to enjoy when they get to these ages. So boomers are really on the cutting edge of this kind of redefinition of what it is to get older. And I think we're going to have to figure out how we can get along as we do that. But there are certainly lots of examples, as you mentioned. In fact, my favorite example, I don't unfortunately remember all the details, but it was one I saw on the network news the other night about a 59-year-old man who still had 1 year of college eligibility left to play football. And so went back to a small college in Texas and is now on the football team this
okay,
season.
Okay, that's a little much. What kinds of demands, Walker, will boomers make on cities as they get older?
Well, I think there are two really big issues that cities face with respect to aging boomers. One of them, I think, is a challenge, and the other, I think, is a big opportunity. The challenge, of course, is the provision of services to older people. To say, of course, that boomers are going to get older and be more active and be healthier is not to say that boomers are not going to need a greater number of services as they get older. Certainly they will. They will need different kinds of services and different levels of services, but they are going to need more services. And many cities are already facing the challenge of providing services to, you know, what social scientists now call naturally occurring retirement communities. You know, most people don't move to Sun City when they retire. They actually retire in place. And so as you have neighborhoods or towns where suddenly the average age is getting older, you discover that these are what they refer to as naturally occurring retirement communities. Lots of older people there. And getting services to these people and providing for their needs, you know, particularly things just like transportation needs, is a real challenge
huge
for cities.
Issue.
And
yeah.
I don't think that's going to go away just because baby boomers are going to be more active and more engaged as they get older. Boomers are going to have these demands too, but boomers are going to ask something different from them. You know, they're not going to say, well, just get me around. You know, they're going to say, take me to the next new adventure. You know, they're not going to say just, you know, get me a basic level of services. They're going to say, you know, give me something that's exciting and that feels, you know, like the next bit of luxury in my life. I want something better, something different, something more engaging. So services is the big challenge. I think the big opportunity for cities is the resource that baby boomers present to them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, boomers are now finding themselves at a time of life when they have more resources. You know, they don't have the same kind of financial demands that they used to have. They don't have the same kind of constraints on their time that they used to have. And as I keep saying, they're very active and very engaged. And so how do communities take advantage of all these people who want to do something? And in many cases, want to give something back. They want to be mentors. They want to be volunteers. They want to get involved in community in a way that, you know, baby boomers have never really been involved in community. And I think cities have an enormous resource coming that if they don't think carefully about what to do with it, you know, this resource is going to take care of itself. You know, boomers will figure out what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think cities should devote some thought not only to how are we going to take care of them, but what can we do to get all of these people engaged in the life of the city and making these cities more vibrant places for all of us. You know, Richard Florida, for example, has talked a lot about the creative class, and I think everything he has to say is very smart about how communities can harness human capital to make themselves into more viable places. And yet, one of the biggest sources of human capital that is emerging is the baby boom generation, and we ought to be planning for that.
Well, you raise a question I've been thinking about a lot lately, Walker, and that is the notion of home and where people are connected. And frankly, many of your essays on Smart City make me think about that question. And do you see boomers? It seems like there's an explosion of second, even third, even fourth homes today.
Sure.
And I'm wondering where people will place their loyalties, particularly boomers who have time, who have money,
right.
who have a legacy that they will ultimately leave, where they leave that, where they invest their time and their money in the meantime, is a question. Do you see that as an issue, number one? And number two, if you do, do you think there are things cities can do to strengthen those connections that boomers would have?
I think this is a big issue for cities. You know, I don't know of any study that's been done about this topic, but there is a lot of anecdotal evidence. You know, there have been a lot of newspaper stories in particular about this very phenomenon of boomers with second homes approaching their second homes very differently than the prior generation, you know, those of them who had second homes. You know, it's not just sort of a getaway and then you come back home. You know, many baby boomers are investing their community loyalties in these second homes and making plans, you know, to one day move there or, if not to move there, at least to spend more time there and to be more mentally and physically engaged in those communities as opposed to the places where they live and work today. You know, because largely people live where they work. And work is the primary driver of decisions that people make about where they live. Now, you know, by the way, this is not to talk about all baby boomers because second home ownership is a very small percentage of boomers. But yet it's a crucial part of the baby boom generation because these do tend to be boomers with more money, more time, who are used to being leaders in other aspects of their lives. And so they're likely to be, you know, one of the more important parts of the baby boom generation that cities want to engage. So I think the challenge of cities is to figure out ways in which they can offer boomers the kinds of things that they're looking for when they're investing their emotional attachments and their community time to these second homes. And I think it goes beyond mere, you know, kind of physical things. I think there is an emotional investment here that is the primary driver of where people put their loyalties and spend their time.
What's part of that? What makes that up? What drives that emotional loyalty?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with you know, the ways in which people feel connected to the community. Now, you know, baby boomers admittedly have just not been very good at investing time in community. You know, there has been a lot of research about this particular topic. And clearly the decline of community in this country, participation in community organizations, that kind of social capital has declined with the baby boom generation, you know, coming of age and assuming a lead position in American society. The turnaround in community really is going to depend upon baby boomers trying to take some lead there to make some reinvestment. And I do think you see boomers beginning to do that. But where cities, you know, don't make it easy for boomers to do that, is providing them a way in which they can have some, you know, emotional investment in the place that they live. The problem is, at home, you know, you don't really go out and search for these things. And so the issue there is different. You can't just sit there and wait for boomers to come knocking on your door. You've really got to go out and offer them things and be more proactive and more aggressive about showing them ways in which they can give something back, make a difference, contribute, feel good about the difference that they're making in those communities. And that's something that cities have to go out and do. Unless you're a college town or a lake town or a beach town and you sort of have the advantage of people moving there and then seeking you out, you know, if you don't have that advantage, you've got to go out and do it on your own.
Walker, I love the book. It's called Generation Ageless, How Baby Boomers Are Changing the Way We Live Today, and They're Just Getting Started. Walker, thanks for being our guest, always on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from Planetizen assistant editor, Nate Berg.
With big cities across the world investing in closed-circuit cameras and hidden microphones to catch criminals and keep the streets safe, a new movement is gathering momentum to take a more passive approach to crime prevention. It's all about fighting crime with design. Law enforcement officials across the country are encouraging planners and urban designers to follow a strategy called Crime Prevention Through Environmental Design, an approach that seeks to make urban areas more uncomfortable for criminals. The Sacramento Bee reports that making a street less crime-friendly can be as easy as propping up a couple more streetlights, but can also include more urbanistic goals such as increasing foot traffic on streets, or performing landscape beautification projects that eliminate possible hiding places, and designing buildings with more windows facing sidewalks and parking lots. And after a redesign of a particularly crime-prone gas station in Sacramento last year, crime has dropped by 33%. Meanwhile, a neighborhood in Bethesda, Maryland is being scouted by developers who want to turn the single-family area into a higher-density mixed-use urban village. The proposed buyout of the neighborhood's 60 homes would create a clean slate for this development, but many residents are opposed to the idea of moving out of what they thought would be the last place they'd ever live. The Washington Post reports that the developers originally offered homeowners more than $3 million apiece for their properties, an amount many found hard to resist. That offer has since been scaled back, but the new price is still far above the market value of these homes. But despite the economic gains to be had, many homeowners have banded together to fight against the proposed buyout, hoping that if the entire 60-house section can't be bought, the developers will be forced to take their projects somewhere else. And while those Maryland residents are fighting to prevent their neighborhood from being turned into a high-rise development, homeowners in Houston are fighting to prevent a high-rise from moving in next door. The Wall Street Journal reports that plans have been approved to build a 23-story high-rise condominium tower in an affluent neighborhood primarily occupied by million-dollar single-family homes. As the only major U.S. city with no zoning laws, Houston pretty much has its hands tied to prevent the project from going forward, despite a vocal group of opponents in the affluent neighborhoods adjacent to the planned tower. This latest land use battle has many in Houston longing for the adoption of zoning laws in the city. But Mayor Bill White says that day will not come on his watch. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk with Mark Stern about natural cultural districts. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Chamber Foundation, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Mark Stern is a professor of social welfare and history and co-director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. Mark's research focuses on U.S. social history and the social impact of the arts. Mark, is the building of major arts and cultural institutions a guaranteed way to revitalize American cities?
Well, I don't think the research really supports that notion, Carol. I think some large center city cultural districts have been successful. Others have been less successful. And once you consider all the costs involved and all the opportunities you pass up to do other things, I think the research is sort of equivocal about whether, you know, they certainly aren't a guarantee.
What's the difference between those that succeed in revitalizing their surroundings and those that do not?
Well, our research suggests that it's connected really to the social ecology of the center, that if you just try to plop down a set of institutions in a social context where there already isn't other things going on, that they have a much less chance of being successful than if, in fact, they build up from pre-existing activities. If there's already a vital cultural scene in a particular area, then investing in building up that cultural scene makes sense. But that moving ahead kind of on a green field or something with a cultural district probably is less likely to succeed.
You've been looking at an alternative way arts and culture can affect revitalization. You've identified something you call natural cultural districts. Describe a natural cultural district.
We use the term natural cultural district to refer to a place in the city where a set of cultural assets come together without there being planning or before planning to put them in a particular place, so that the resources, which may vary from nonprofits to for-profit cultural firms to just individual artists, identify that it makes sense both in terms of being connected to one another and in terms of the neighborhood in which they're located to locate in a particular place. And what we've discovered is that, first of all, these districts have an impact on the vitality of the cultural scene, that in a sense the different artists, the different organizations feed off one another. So there's a impact in terms of the what gets produced in terms of art. But as importantly, what we found is that it has – these natural cultural districts have a very clear and persistent effect in terms of the overall quality of life in those neighborhoods.
Let's go back and talk about this first piece. The districts have an impact on the cultural scene. Why is that? Is it the proximity of people? Is it the fact that people are in proximity and have places to meet? I mean, if you deconstruct the natural cultural district and its elements, what are those elements that make it have that impact on the cultural scene?
Well, I think on the one hand, having a lot of creative assets located close to one another just spurs innovation, that people get ideas from one another, see what's going on in one sphere and then see how it works in another sphere. So there's kind of a push on innovation. The other side of it, I think, has to do with just the availability of people to do things. I mean, one of the things that's notable about these districts is there are a lot of artists working in these districts and also often living in these districts. So you're in a situation where, you know, the artists are there and that, you know, allows the organizations and the for-profit firms to have people to use in terms of, you know, trying new things and moving ahead. So I think on the one hand, it has to do with there's sort of an innovation impact. On the other hand, I think just the availability of the assets you need to kind of move ahead in terms of a cultural enterprise.
It's funny in a world where we think we're globally connected that being together in a neighborhood, being in close proximity in a neighborhood becomes important just to the, as you say, the availability of people to do things.
Yeah, well, you know, in my mind, it's the same as the difference between surfing something on the internet and sitting down in a library. You know, there's a way in which having all the books right in front of you, you might pull one off the shelf that you hadn't thought about looking at. And I think there's an availability, you know, if you have a bunch of artists sitting around in a neighborhood, something might occur to someone that, you know, wasn't intentional, they didn't go looking for, but suddenly it's there. So I do think, you know, it's not only in culture, but I think particularly in creative enterprises, the kind of innovation through accident is a really important dimension to how these firms can be successful.
Talk about the consumer role, if you'll let me use that word, the consumer
Sure.
or the participant role in these districts. And I also want you to address what you learned about diversity in these neighborhoods.
Well, you know, there's two parts to it. On the one hand, one of the things – we've been doing research on cultural assets in Philadelphia for over a decade now. And one of the things that's been most persistent in terms of our findings is that neighborhoods that have different kinds of diversity, that are ethnically diverse, that have economically diverse populations, and that have different kinds of households and different kinds of family forms living in them, are the neighborhoods that always have the highest levels of cultural vitality. So there's a way in which I think when we look at these natural cultural districts, diverse neighborhoods are neighborhoods that are most likely to attract the artists, the nonprofit firms, the for-profit firms. So that part leads into it. And then I think, you know, one of the things we've discovered is that there's a reinforcing process. You have you have nonprofits located in a particular neighborhood, and that spurs participation in that neighborhood. And then as the participation level of local residents increases, I think that also pulls in other cultural resources. So I think it's a, you know, kind of a virtuous cycle where having cultural opportunities in a neighborhood reinforces participation, but at the same time, participation reinforces, you know, the attraction of other cultural assets to that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. And again, if a community were attempting to be deliberate about this, I mean, perhaps I should ask, can you be deliberate about the creation of a natural cultural district or the, those manifestations of these natural cultural districts?
Yeah. Well, you know, we use the term cultivating these natural cultural districts because, you know, in contrast to a planned cultural district, I don't think you can just lay down a thing of blacktop and then start building one of these up. But I do think there are lots of neighborhoods that have kind of the ingredients that feed into a natural cultural district. Now, not every neighborhood that has those ingredients necessarily will become a district that attracts people from across the region. But I think you can do planning in terms of if you start with a set of assets, building those assets in a particular direction. So we use the term natural kind of in quotation marks. I mean, what we're really talking about is where you're built, where a neighborhood or a particular district of the city builds on its assets rather than just trying to create it on a blank slate. And I think there are things you can do to forward that.
Well, let's talk about those. I love this idea of cultivation, but I don't think it comes naturally to public policy, to public officials. I mean, it's like I want something to happen. I want something now to happen, and I am going to be intentional about this. So how do you back up a bit and think about cultivation?
Well, I guess I think of three different ways that say external actors can come in and help one of these districts move forward. One thing we've discovered is that the firms and the nonprofits in these districts face a whole set of kind of regulatory concerns, license and inspection, obviously taxes, a whole set of things that, these natural culture districts often share with small business across the whole city.
Right.
So there's a set of issues there. A second set of concerns have to do with technical assistance. I think especially the artists and the smaller for-profit cultural firms very often do not have the range of expertise they need to kind of make it as a business. And this is another place where I think cities, foundations, other people who are interested in moving ahead with policy could make a big difference. And then the final one, and probably ultimately the most important one, is capital investment. I think this is the area we understand the least. I don't think we're at a point where we could actually produce a formula that says here's a good investment and here's a bad investment in terms of investing in cultural assets. But certainly for these places to grow and prosper, they need someone to step up and provide the investment. You know, I think one of the things we've been working with the Reinvestment Fund, which is a community development financial institution in Philadelphia. And one of the conversations we're having with them is what are their standards for judging the quality of an investment in their other sectors, and how might those apply to the cultural sectors? Because one of the things we discovered was that, in fact, TRF, the Reinvestment Fund, already about 8% of their investments were already in cultural firms. So we were saying, okay, you decided these were good investments. What were the decisions? What were the factors that allowed you to make those decisions? And, you know, I'll say we've asked the questions. I don't know if we've really gotten full answers to that. But I do think an area where there needs to be further understanding is how can you judge these, cultural districts in process and make a decision about where it makes sense to invest and where it doesn't make sense to invest.
Well, that raises a question, Mark, that again, I think about a lot, and that is this notion of urban entrepreneurs, which I think, again, begins to overlap and intersect with certainly cultural entrepreneurs, because many people go into a retail business, a restaurant business. I mean, sure, they want to make money. At the very least, they want to make a salary. I mean, they want to make an income for themselves. But so many times it's really more out of a passion to make a statement or to have an impact on the neighborhood or to show a particular kind of clothing, maybe their own. You see a lot of that in Philadelphia, in Northern Liberties and Fishtown. I'm wondering, one, how those two groups overlap in your research. And then, again, what are those markers, perhaps, in neighborhoods that begin to say to the real pioneers, this is a place that you can invest and not get killed? That you might provide the tipping point. Have you explored those issues?
As I said, I think we've asked those questions. I can't say we've gotten answers to them. You know, in terms of your first point, I think what we've found through our research, we did a survey of a number of neighborhoods in terms of how local residents think about creativity. And one of the things we discovered was that they start the kind of on the ground in urban neighborhoods. There's a very broad notion of what's involved in creativity, ranging from kind of the classic notion of arts and culture to a wider range of activities working on cars, decorating the house, how one dresses. So I think there's a way in which it's very hard to draw a clear line where the arts and culture ends and where these other forms of urban entrepreneurs start. I think there's a continuum that links the kind of more traditional arts and culture to this wider range of creative pursuits.
I want to come back to these natural cultural districts, and that there's a concept that you use called the POV Prof community. Tell me what that is and how it relates to natural cultural districts.
Well, it's funny because earlier I was talking about how sometimes you stumble upon something you weren't looking for. When we first started this research in the 90s, we were just looking at straightforward correlations between high levels of cultural engagement and different kinds of census and other kinds of variables. And just suddenly one day we were looking and we said, well, that's funny. If your neighborhood has more professionals than the average neighborhood in the city, you're more likely to have these cultural assets. And if your poverty rate is high, you're more likely to have these assets. So at first we said, well, that must be a mistake. And I went back and, in fact, I redesigned the whole analysis because I thought I was using too large of a geographic district. But then we broke it down to even smaller districts and we came back with the same results. So lo and behold, we went in and what we discovered was that there are a significant number of parts of a city that have what we call these POV-PROF districts, or economic diversity, that have both a higher level of poverty than the city as a whole, but that are also home to more professionals and managers than the average neighborhood. And in fact, there's a connection between the POV-PROF neighborhoods and what we see as these diverse household diverse neighborhoods. That is, neighborhoods with more non-family households, more couples without kids, more gay and lesbian households, that those two factors very often interfere. So, this notion that the real neighborhoods of a city are the neighborhoods that are homogeneous in terms of ethnicity or economic status, I think is one of the things that's we found really isn't relevant in terms of talking about arts and culture. These POV-PROF neighborhoods just always come through as a place where things are happening, and a place where a lot of what we call these natural cultural districts occur.
Mark Stern is co-director of the Urban Studies Program at the University of Pennsylvania. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Keith Bellows is editor of National Geographic Traveler. Keith, your October cover story is the second annual selection of Tours of a Lifetime, 50 of the World's Best Trips. And there are some stunning photographs that accompany that story. But how do you possibly decide which tours make it to your list?
This is a process that takes us about the entire year between the time we start and when we finish it. And we basically look for three things. The first thing is the tour has to be absolutely superb. The second thing is it needs to be sort of sustainably correct. In other words, we're looking for tour operators that are doing it right, that are, leaving places in as good shape as when they found it. And then the third thing is we're looking for geographic mix and mix of types of tours. And of course, one of the things that's happening in the tour business is that we've moved away from the idea of, grannies on a bus, and we're much more willing to put our interests in the hands of real experts, because more and more these tours are taking us to the far-flung corners of the world. And also in our own backyard, we've just launched a sort of a component of this called Places of a Lifetime. It's actually Tours of a Lifetime is part of the bigger picture Places of a Lifetime, and we've started rolling out online what will be 50 of the world's greatest places, and these will be covered in a great deal of depth, from everything from go before you go, books, movies, recipes,
wow,
music that you can sort of sample before you actually get on a plane and go to Shanghai. Certainly there'll be all the usual very in-depth basics. There'll be the best restaurants, the best hotels, really selected by people on the ground, walking tours. So these will be very very up-to-date, very deep packages. And the 10 that are up now is Beijing and Hong Kong. We've got London, we've got San Francisco and Washington, and of course New York, Miami. So it's, as I say, it's rolling out. It's a huge undertaking, because as you can appreciate, 50 major world cities with, which have to be sort of reported from the ground up by people in each of those cities.
Oh, that sounds like a fabulous resource. In fact, you've named at least two cities that I'm headed to in the next month, so I can't wait to check it out. Your monthly City Life column, is one of my favorites, and this month you feature Phoenix, a city that's actually getting a lot of attention these days. You call it newly cool. Why?
It is, and I've actually been to Phoenix about three times in the last year, and it's one of those cities that sort of gets a bad rap because people think of it as this sort of, out in the arid desert. It's where Scottsdale's a little close to that, so people think of it as sort of a retirement haven, all of which has been true. But it is now really emerging as an art center, as a food place, and of course, it's got the usual stuff, the golf and the outdoor activities and what have you. But it's a big city. It's growing 100,000 people a year. The downside of that is, of course, the traffic's getting bad, but they're putting in a light rail system, which should open, I think, in December of next year. And so it's an emerging first-class American city.
Yeah. Tokyo is also featured in the City Life column this month, October. It's such a frenetic city. How do you take it in as a traveler in a sane way? It's really intimidating.
It is a city on steroids, and what we have in this issue is a walking tour, and it probably is a good way to start. And one of the places that it hits in the walking tour is Shizuoka Market, which is the world's biggest fish market. It's astonishing. You go there at 4 o'clock in the morning, and it's really a separate city in and of itself. They sell more fish in a week than the Fulton Fish Market sells in a year.
Wow.
But you ask the question of how do you deal with it? You just have to be willing to be overwhelmed, to walk the streets, and to be perfectly truthful. I highly recommend that you hire a tour guide for the day, because unless you speak Japanese, you can get lost very, very quickly.
I want to come back a minute to your cover story, Tours of a Lifetime. I noticed that you included a number of volunteer vacations in the list. How strong is that trend today?
It's a very strong trend. And I think what we're seeing is you know, a lot of people talk about luxury travel, and I think that now we're getting to a point where people want to do more than just sort of spend money to have fun and pamper themselves. They really do want to have sort of an ethical luxury component to it, where they leave something behind. They do something, you know, to better the planet. They you know, they want to help out. And this phenomenon, you know, we saw it emerging about 10 years ago, but now it's a full-fledged, you know, component of the travel industry.
Do you imagine that developing on the domestic side as well?
I think so. And I think what will happen, you know, you've got a new generation of travelers that are coming out of our colleges. And from everything I've read and I can see, this is maybe a more altruistic group of kids. And so it's very likely that as you have the baby boomers sort of looking back and saying, geez, what have we been doing for the last 30 years? We need to put something, you know, we need to leave a better legacy. You combine that with the kids that are coming out saying, hey, you know, I want to make a difference.
Interesting. One of the advantages of magazines, of a travel magazine versus a travel book, is you feel like the information is much more current. Now that you've put Places of a Lifetime online and doing in-depth profiles of great world cities, you feel like, well, that could be even more up-to-date. But I'm curious, as an editor, how often you expect your writers to come back and update those profiles with new information, new restaurants, the latest and greatest, so that when a would-be traveler goes online, how current is the information? How current?
It's really, really current. And in fact, one of the hallmarks of the Geographic is that we are fanatics about facts. We have a very big research department on the magazine. Nothing goes out this door that hasn't been fact-checked 6 ways to Sunday. And what we're going to do is 3 things. One is ask consumers to spot, you know, they say, well, you know, that restaurant just went out of business, you know, that kind of thing. As we roll this out, and obviously there's some huge technological issues here, we are going to eventually open it up so that consumers can add their own choices, their own ideas, their own tips, and they will be flagged as such, and they will also be researched and screened, so that we can make this a more organic resource. Because it is true, you know, a magazine, when we put a magazine out, it's been fact-checked right up until the last minute, and it's pretty darn fresh. But a product that we've put up online that's going to live for, you know, years needs to be, you know, equally fresh, and we're very, very cognizant of that.
Well, Keith, if we can find you at home and off the road, we'll talk to you next month.
That's great.
Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.